Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Division. I'd like to call the committee to order. We do have a quorum present. And let's see, do we have minutes that we need to approve here? Okay. Could I get a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Cantrell moves to approve the minutes of February 20th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. All right, so members, we are here to take up House File 1 today, and Representative Katiza Watun is here with Representative Pinto also. And I just want to alert members, we do not have a fiscal note for the bill right now. And for this reason, we are not going to vote on the bill today. We're going to lay it over at the end of the hearing. When we have a fiscal note, we will take the bill up again, which will not be today. This is a large bill. There's a lot in it, and we want to be sure that members have a chance to review the fiscal note before we take it up for a vote. So that is the intention today, and I just want to alert members to that. And so as we get started here, we have present, you may notice a difference in our lineup here at the front table with our staff. And Annie Mock, who is the fiscal analyst with the House Research with the Early Childhood Committee, is here with us today because this bill came out of early childhood. And she is going to walk us through which provisions are actually in front of our committee, because as members probably know, we have in this bill, well, the Early Childhood Committee kind of has dual jurisdiction. Part of its work is in the education side, part of it in the HHS side. And so the bill contains provisions from both, and we are only going to be concerned here today with the HHS provisions. So, Ms. Mock, if you would like to go ahead and walk us through.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. You should have in front of you a document with two tables on it, and I'm going to be going through the first table on that document, which is the Health and Human Service provisions of this House File 1, the First Division Engrossment, as amended by the A6 Amendment. So starting with Article 1, Sections 1 and 2, these are sections establish a home visiting program for pregnant women and families with children and appropriate $30 million for the program. Article 2, Section 1, makes changes to the quality rating and improvement system, known as Parent Aware. So this would direct the Commissioner of Human Services to arrange evaluation of the program. And you'll note here that there isn't an appropriation here for Health and Human Services. However, there is an appropriation in the second table because the appropriation of $1.65 million actually gets appropriated to the Department of Education and then transferred to the Department of Human Services. Back to the first table, looking at Article 2, Sections 10 and 11. This is as for a Family Child Care Regulation Modernization Program. This directs the Department of Human Services to contract with a consultant or an organization to develop a proposal for a risk-based model for monitoring compliance with family child care licensing standards and appropriates $1.5 million for this project. Article 3, Section 1 has to do with the CCAP rates, and it would modify the rates to bring them to the 25th percentile of the market rate in the geographic area with the highest cost 25th percentile in the most recent child care provider rate survey. So more simply, it would bring federal compliance and also make a statewide rate. Article 3, Sections 2 and 11 have to do with the retaining early educators through Attaining Incentives Now program, or the Retain Grant program, which provides competitive grants to incentivize well-trained child care professionals to stay in the workforce. And this would appropriate $2.5 million to that program. Article 3, Sections 3, 4, and 12 have to do with the Teacher Education and Compensation Helps Grant Program, or the TEACH Grant Program, and making modifications to that program and appropriating $500,000. Article 3, Sections 5 and 8 would establish a Family Friend and Neighbor Grant Program, which would direct the Commissioner of Health to make grants available to fund community organizations that partner with family, friend, and neighbor caregivers, and also to make grants to fund community-based partnerships for early literacy programs. And this would appropriate $1 million. Article 3, Section 6 and 7 are for a grant to First Children's Finance, and that grant is to be used for loans for improving or planning, designing, and constructing childcare or early education sites. And that grant would be for the appropriation would be for $3 million. And then Article 3, Section 9, is appropriations related to CCAP, so $20 million for reducing the basic sliding fee waiting list, and then $170 million to increase the childcare rates on a one-time basis.
All right, thank you very much. So so before we go to the presentation of the bill, any clarification needed on what Ms. Mock just went through? Okay, all right, thank you very much. All right, so who's gonna start? Representative Pinto, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. And so members, I'm here as the first co-author with the bill's author, Representative Cutiz Witoon, because House File 1 really represents a lot of the thinking of our early childhood committee over the last year. And we're really excited to be presenting this bill to you. And I just want to make sure to highlight that it really is aimed at addressing two separate but interconnected crises that our state is facing. One is the crisis of opportunity gaps between Minnesotans of different backgrounds, that we know that those gaps start in the very first weeks and months and years of life. And then also the incredible childcare crisis that we're suffering in terms of parents and families having difficulty accessing care, providers being paid very little, et cetera. So it's really aimed at both of those. And then I think the plan is to have Representative Cutiz Witoon present the bill, and then we'll be ready for testifiers and questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Cutiz Witoon, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, advocates, parents, and caregivers, good afternoon. We are so excited to be here to discuss the new and improved Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act. As you may know, House File 1 is a bold set of investments to support our youngest Minnesotans and their families by addressing, as Chair Pinto mentioned, both the persistent opportunity gap and the nationwide child care crisis. In the early childhood division last year, we heard frequently just how important the first few years of life, prenatal through pre-K, truly impacts the rest of a child's life. In House File 1, we highlight some critical initiatives to stem the opportunity gap here in Minnesota by investing in home visiting opportunities, both child care assistance and scholarships to help families cover the cost of child care, and supporting child care providers by increasing rates, providing grants for potential improvements in delivery, and offering the opportunity for ongoing process improvement. We know that there are thousands more children and families that we can help. So this year, we are doing everything that we can to meet Minnesota's families where they are right now. Children are only young once, and now is the time to invest in them. This is a down payment on the future of our state. Our kids can't wait. Their future begins today. And as a parent to three young children, I empathize with the families who are struggling to find quality, affordable childcare across the state. I know firsthand what it's like to spend almost twice a mortgage payment in childcare costs, or to try and figure out whether to take unpaid time away from work to care for children, or spend much, if not all, of a paycheck on childcare. These are the tough choices that parents in Minnesota are dealing with on a daily basis. I'm grateful for the testifiers who will share their stories about the positive impact that scholarships and CCAP have had on their lives. Just last week in early childhood, as well as I believe here in your committee, we heard from DHS on the numerous improvements made to their process to strengthen program integrity. This was a huge focus of our work last year, and with the adjustments that we made together, we can feel confident that increased spending to the child care assistance program and to the provider reimbursement rates will help even more families in need. I value the insights of providers sharing the challenges that they have in providing high quality delivery with low reimbursement rates. An update to this proposal, based on feedback from our Greater Minnesota Advocates, is moving to one consistent statewide reimbursement rate for family-based childcare. Additionally, this proposal includes numerous grant opportunities to better support childcare providers as they get their business off the ground or take desired steps to grow their business and continue developing essential skills in this ever-evolving industry. It's clearer now than ever the economics of childcare just don't work. When we listen to parents and providers, we hear that there is not a one-size-fits-all delivery model that works for every family, and there are improvements that we can make in regulatory reform to better support providers of all types. In order to aid providers in making these potential delivery improvements, we must continue to adjust our own processes, including an evaluation of Parent Aware. To better discern where we may encourage providers to improve delivery and see how we can all better prepare our children for a lifetime of learning, investing in a consistent kindergarten readiness assessment is also crucial. I appreciate and acknowledge the expertise of our medical and community development professionals who shared the data showing us that these outcomes, these investments, have a measurable impact on outcomes. The research that we've seen has driven much of our focus to shift investment directly to our youngest Minnesotans and littlest learners. The variety of advocates across the early childhood spectrum supporting this bill is a welcome reminder that while no single piece of legislation can get us exactly where we want to go, when we work together and provide support for families when and where they need it the most, we can accomplish wonderful things. There's a thing about investing. Someone is sitting in the shade today because someone planted a tree long ago. When we take the steps necessary to fulfill our commitment to each Minnesota child that they may reach their true potential, we are planting that tree. Every child deserves a great start to life here in Minnesota, and we all benefit when that happens. I know that while we have a long way to go, that this package is also a great start. With that, Madam Chair, I will give a high-level overview of just how we're going to do it.
All right. Thank you very much. Oh.
And before we move on to the testifiers, I would like to move the A6 author's amendment.
Yes. First of all, the Chair will move House File 1 to put it before the committee, and then do we have the author's amendment right behind it? Oh, I see. Okay. So, and then the Chair will move the 1A6 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. So we do need to adopt the amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Representative Katiza Watun, do you want to just maybe give us a very brief explanation of what the amendment does?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mainly just technical changes. I know when Ms. Mock just walked through the appropriation division here and just the sections that we're going to focus on here in HHS, that was per the A6 amendment.
Okay.
So it is
very good. So is there any discussion? All right. All those in favor of adopting the 1A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay. So now that we have the bill in the order in which you'd like to discuss it, go ahead,
Thank you. So the Health and Human Services provisions is a total of $230.15 million in total out of the $500 million within the bill. $170 million is a one-time funding for a child care assistance rate increase up to a maximum of the 75th percentile of the most recent survey, which would be 2018 for now, 2021, et cetera, going forward. And federal minimum federal compliance is set at 25% of the most recent survey thereafter. A one-time amount, mainly because of the 75 percentile max, some funding is expected to go into the tails. This also includes the single statewide rate that I mentioned for family care, and rates continue to vary geographically for center-based care. There's $20 million for a one-time funding for the child care assistance waiting list reduction, $30 million for one-time funding for home visiting grants, $7 million in one-time provider supports, those grants that I spoke about, $3 million for First Children's Finance, $2.5 million for the retain and teach grants, $1 million for family, friend, and neighbor care, and $500,000 for teacher education. Oh, sorry. It was a total of $3 million for the retain and teach combined. $1.65 million for an evaluation of the Parent Aware program, and $1.5 million to develop a proposal for new child care regulation licensing model per the recommendations from our Family Child Care Task Force.
Okay, thank you very much. So let's, are we ready then to take testimony? We have several testifiers. So members, please hold questions if you would and just make note of them, and then at the end we'll have, I think, plenty of time to ask questions. So I'd like to call up Ann McCulley. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Ann McCulley. I serve as Executive Director of Child Care Aware of Minnesota. We are a nonprofit agency that works at the intersection of three important stakeholder groups when it comes to early care and education. We support parents in their search for early care and education options. We provide early childhood educators with professional development opportunities, scholarships and grants, and technical assistance to help them build and sustain their programs. And we work in partnership with community-based efforts all over the state through our network of 14 local agencies. House File 1 reflects a number of initiatives that speak to the needs shared by all of these stakeholder groups, but I want to use one unifying theme that is also shared by the public-private collaborative Transforming Minnesota's Early Childhood Workforce, on which I also serve. Minnesota's early childhood workforce is the cornerstone of high-quality early care and education. Minnesota needs qualified, diverse, supported, and equitably compensated early childhood educators so that parents can go to work, businesses can hire employees, and children can thrive. Being an early childhood educator is critically important, and yet we all know that the early childhood workforce is undervalued and undercompensated. In Minnesota, one-third of our early childhood workforce actually qualifies for public assistance, and Minnesota spends at least $43 million per year in public assistance to support these primarily female workers. Strategies to help address the compensation issue, even in the form of short-term financial relief, will go a long way towards stabilizing the field in this time of flux and allow our parents and communities to continue to benefit from these important programs. To begin, I want to stress the importance of funding the Child Care Assistance Program. The increase in reimbursement rates, the need for the increase in reimbursement rates cannot be overstated. This program has never fully recovered from major cuts made back in 2003. These cuts led to significant changes in reimbursement, and the field's been struggling to catch up ever since. We are now out of federal compliance in the amount we reimburse our child care programs and providers, and this amount is so low it makes it difficult for the majority of those who want to support the families and children on this program to do so without a financial loss. Based on fiscal year 2019 DHS data, only 16% of licensed family child care providers and 23% of centers statewide can cover their price fully with the current reimbursement rate. What this means is that these programs either have to eat this difference, attempt to cover it through other means such as scholarships, or they have to ask the parents to pay it, which can be difficult because these parents are already very low income. So we need to address this disparity. Two other elements of the bill are programs that our agency currently administers, the Teach Early Childhood Minnesota Scholarship Program and the Retain Workforce Retention Program. I believe there are handouts in the packets as well as over here about those programs, so I'll just hit the highlights. Teach Early Childhood is a national scholarship program that is licensed in 20 states to help early childhood and school-age professionals in both center-based and family childcare home settings increase their levels of education, compensation, and commitment to the field by earning college credits and degrees. The program began in Minnesota in 2002 and has helped over 1,000 early educators attain their degree or certificate. Teach scholarships cover 85% of the cost of tuition and books for up to 18 semester credits, as well as travel stipend and release time. And recipients also receive a raise or a one-time bonus at the completion of their contract. They also commit to staying in their place of employment for 1 year after each contract. The Retain Grant Program started in 2003 and has supported over 2,000 early childhood professionals to date. This program is open to those who have been working full-time for at least 1 year in their current position and have already completed a CDA certificate or higher education degree in early childhood or a related field. The program offers a small bonus of $500 to $3,500 depending on the applicant's education level. In return, the recipient agrees to remain working in their current position for an additional year. And these bonuses can be used to cover personal or professional expenses that help the providers meet their needs. And there is some evaluation data in your packet about Retain as well. Finally, I do want to quickly mention two other elements that are in the bill that would positively impact our workforce. The first is funding for First Children's Finance to continue and expand their good work in the community to support the business side of childcare. As a longtime member of their loan fund committee, I can speak with confidence about the important role they play. And I want to say a final word about the section related to family child care regulation modernization. mouthful. This is a request that stems from the Family Child Care Task Force, on which I also serve, and it will develop a risk-based model for monitoring compliance with licensing standards. I think this is an important step toward addressing concerns voiced by our family child care providers about streamlining some of the regulations while protecting the important health and safety provisions of our licensing. So on behalf of Child Care Aware of Minnesota and Transforming Minnesota's Early Childhood Workforce Team, I thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to hold questions for now, so if you would stay and in case there are any, but thank you for your testimony. Next will be Daniel Gumnet. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Gumnet, and I'm the CEO of People Serving People. Today I'm here on behalf of People Serving People, the Minnesota Prenatal to Three Coalition, and Kids Can't Wait. We support House File 1. People Serving People is the region's largest shelter and most comprehensive shelter for children experiencing homelessness. We're also the largest shelter serving parenting youth 18 to 24 years of age. Located in downtown Minneapolis, People Serving People works at the epicenter of family homelessness in Minnesota. We shelter nearly 2,000 very young children and their families a year. Every morning, 30 to 40 buses line up in front of People Serving People to take young children to schools around the region. Our families are strong, our children are amazing, and our families experiencing homelessness are striving to do the best they can for their young children. Even though People Serving People is an emergency shelter, our largest investments are in early education and parental engagement. We have 4-star parent aware rated programs at our shelter and our center of excellence in the Phillips neighborhood. And often we are the first structured learning environment that children experiencing homelessness participate in. Every day we see firsthand the terrible toll and trauma and toxic stress of homelessness takes on the healthy development of very young children. We also see the profound benefits that quality early education programs can provide to the whole family, that is the children and the parents. Much of the groundbreaking research on building resiliency in children experiencing homelessness conducted by Professor Ann Mastin and her associates at the University of Minnesota has been done in partnership with the University of Minnesota since the early 1980s. We know that it's absolutely necessary that children experiencing homelessness be ready for kindergarten so they're reading at grade level by third grade. However, many children experiencing homelessness in Minnesota have significantly greater needs than their stably housed peers. Because homelessness causes trauma, our experience and research demonstrate that trauma-informed quality early education programs make a dramatic difference in the lives of children experiencing homelessness. Our families rely heavily on child care assistance programs. However, finding space in programs can be extremely difficult because the current provider rates are so low, providers can't often afford to accept children relying on child care assistance. This means that providers lose money if they choose to serve families using child care assistance, making it difficult for providers to serve low-income families, stay in business or grow, provide quality care, and pay their staff. In conclusion, we passionately believe that if we're going to permanently break the cycle of homelessness and poverty, we need to expand access to financial resources such as child care assistance for children age prenatal to three. This prioritization is vital in reducing family homelessness, closing the education opportunity gap, and developing our state's future workforce. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and if you would also please stay around in case there are questions, we would appreciate it.
Absolutely, thank you.
Thank you. Mary Solheim. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Mary Solheim, and I am a child care director in Maplewood, Minnesota. And I'm here today with Kids Count on Us to share that face on what we're all trying to solve the problem for. Our child care center has been there for 34 years. It's an outdoor program that serves kids early childhood learning from ages 14 months all the way up through obviously 12 and above when we have higher needs. But what I'm here today is to support House File 1. House File 1 is important to begin that first step. I wanted to give you an example of my little corner of the world of what our kids look like when they come to play school. We have 30 families that are on the on child care assistance right now. Those families represent 20 of our African American kids, 3 of our Native American families. We have 6 kids that are Caucasian. We have 1 Hispanic family. And those numbers double when our summer programs begin. 24 of those kids are on IEPs in the school centers. 2 of those kids are level 4 behavioral support programs. The other 2 are 2 level 3s. And 4 of those kids that are on IEPs are also on the autism spectrum disorder. When we look at the kind of needs that are walking and flooding into our child care centers, we're looking at how to support those needs. This file, as House File 1, would be so important to being able to help all of our centers reach the needs of the kids that come through our doors. There is a saying in disability justice organization that goes, nothing about us without us is for us. And providers every day are working so hard to actively try and fix the problems that this crisis in childcare has created. Please support this. And thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, please stay in case there are questions. Okay, Representative Katiza Watun, did you want to say anything further before we open it up for questions? And we do have a number of members on the list.
Hi. Or Representative. I don't think so, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Well, great. So we'll start with just to let everybody know, we've got Schultz, Haley, Hamilton, Baker, Grunhagen, and if there are others, you know, please add your name. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So I have a question about the amendment and how these payments to providers are handled, and I'm looking at page 2 of the amendment, line 2.21. So in St. Louis County and in Duluth, my district, we're really struggling with affordable child care. And we've had historically low rates of reimbursement in the CCAP program. And I think I heard you mention that we're going to have the same rate in counties. But could you just explain the payments by the county variation in payments in line 2.21 and how that's going to affect St. Louis County?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Schultz for the question. So the way that this would work is that, and this is used in a number of states, including New Mexico, actually, where it's a survey that's done of providers in the metro area, and then that rate is the same rate that applies to providers throughout the state, so it's not geographically based any longer for family care. If I'm understanding your question, it may not be, but that at least will start answering it.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So it says market rate in the county. Are these still based on county rates? And if it's a survey, if we've had historically low reimbursement rate, is that going to be based on those historic low rates?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, I understand the concern. So line 2.21 says the 25th percentile, that the rate is set at the 25th percentile of the market rate in the county with the highest cost 25th percentile. In other words, you look to the highest cost community, which is going to be most likely a metro community, that then sets the benchmark for the entire state. And I guess I do want to highlight this is quite a friendly provision for providers in communities that have lower cost of living, potentially more rural communities, because the rate is benchmarked to the highest cost.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. One more question. So in the underlying bill, before it was amended, you had deleted the lines where it calls out counties of Benton, Sherburne, and Stearns, and in the amendment they're included. Why are we highlighting those three counties? Line 2.27 in the amendment.
Right.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz. The reason for that is that the underlying bill would have gone to a single statewide rate for all child care providers. Mm-hmm. That's what they do in New Mexico and some other states. We did receive a lot of concern from providers, from center-based providers, saying, well, wait a second. It's not just that our rates vary, our costs significantly vary too. Your cost of your property in Minneapolis is going to be kind of different than your cost in Mazeppa, for example. And so the cost may vary somewhat less for family care, so that would be a reason to keep it for family care. But the concern was that for center-based, we probably should keep the geographic variability. And so the language that was crossed off in the original bill would have gone to a single statewide rate for all providers. There is now the necessity, I think, in the language that remains to deal with St. Cloud, which is what the reference to Benton, Sherwood, and Stearns is about, for that purpose. I think that's right. Maybe Ms. Mock has something to add that
right.
Research can help.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Thank you, mm-hmm. Schultz. And I just, I was reminded, and actually I remembered that this was put in by former Representative Knobloch to deal, I remember it very well, and maybe some of you do as well, and it deals with these three counties come together in St. Cloud, and they had different rates. And so he was trying to make sure that they all got the higher rate instead of it being kind of the arbitrariness of being in one county versus the other. And it does kind of point out exactly what the bill is doing, which is trying to remove some of that variation that can be somewhat arbitrary. So Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions might be for Ann McCulley, but I can ask them and you can determine. Thanks for bringing the bill forward. I have some series of questions around the kindergarten readiness assessment and wondered, maybe that's not you.
Yeah.
I'm wondered if the bill, do you have a particular assessment tool that you've selected?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Madam Chair, and Representative, or maybe perhaps Madam Chair, so I'll leave up to you. That's actually an education part of the bill. But with the Chair's permission, we can talk about it.
Yeah, you know, I realize that we're not all on education, and I struggle with this myself, but I'd really rather, maybe Representative Pinto, if you can answer really briefly, but I'd thank you for flagging that. I would really rather we not. I mean, this is a fiscal committee, it's an HHS committee. I'd rather we didn't go off into the education-only kind of parts of the bill. But please, if you can give a brief answer.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
If you prefer, Madam Chair, I can just kind of raise my overall issue for the record, and then you can move on, then we can talk offline.
Sure, I think that would be fine. If it's education-related, it probably belongs in the education committee. But anyway, go ahead, Representative Haley.
Just in this whole area, and again, that we can talk online. And I did some work in a previous life in kindergarten assessment. So the idea of putting the money in, I support, but the full loop of then how do we work back with those child care providers once you know if kids aren't meeting the assessment, then what do we do to actually change things downstream so that they are? Otherwise, it's kind of an effort in futility. And I was concerned as well with the parent aware ratings that the bill changes the deadline so that only 40% of providers have to meet parent aware, and was curious if that in effect is reducing standards when we've tried to raise standards. So I can follow up with you on all those issues, and then I do have a financial question if I can move to that one.
Sure. Representative Pinto, can you answer briefly?
Very briefly, Madam Chair, and Representative Haley. So there is some expertise in the room on the kindergarten readiness assessment piece, so maybe it does make sense to we'll make sure we have those folks connect with you separately since it's not an education committee, but I know that there is expertise in the room to answer it. I'm seeing Ms. Keller come down, although I don't know if we're going to get to it since education, but she's available. And then the parent aware evaluation, the parent aware issue, there actually was a request. That's, I think, a consensus among a number of folks. I guess Ms. Keller probably can talk about that as well, about the need to delay requiring a 3 and 4 star to only be able to get funded. With the Chair's permission, maybe have Ms. Keller just respond on the parent aware piece. piece.
Okay, if you can do that briefly, because again, we're way off into the education piece, but it is hard to separate these things sometimes. So
absolutely, absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cisa Keller. I'm the Senior Vice President of Early Childhood Quality Development at Think Small. And so I'll just talk specifically to the parent aware component in trying to, so as we have the Early Learning Scholarships rolling out, that is a newer program. It was only available statewide in 2015. And so we wanted it available to all providers that were participating in parent aware through that rollout. And what we were hoping was that we would have a certain percentage of providers that were reaching, were participating, and we are doing very good as we roll that out across the state, but realizing we're not quite at that point in which we want to not allow providers who have earned a 1 or 2 star to not be eligible for early learning scholarships. So rather than just keep putting a year in, we thought it made more sense to actually put in basically a saturation point. So when we get to 40% of our providers throughout the state that are participating in parent aware, at that point we will move to having early learning scholarships only available to early childhood providers that have earned a 3 or 4 star rating.
Okay, Representative Haley, did you want to move to your fiscal question?
Certainly, and thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at the early learning scholarships, the $190 million that you're putting in for the one-time increase, I don't see that there's a guarantee that those funds will be spent on scholarships, and I was concerned about that because, to my understanding, the last round of funding that we allocated, MDE wasn't able to fully spend what we allocated, and there was an unspent balance of $4.5 million. So we're putting more in when we couldn't spend the last amount that we allocated.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I think more of an education question, Representative Haley, but just to address it briefly, my understanding is that just because of the way that the funds end up working, there might be a part year, et cetera, a family can't necessarily use all the funds in a given year. So there was a special revenue fund created that had this $4.5 million, as you referenced. But the funding in the bill that would go to each of these buckets goes to those buckets, and the scholarships actually goes to that special revenue fund and then is used in that way. So there's no danger of being used for something else.
Okay. Thank you, but I guess I still have a concern the way the language is written that special fund could be used for other things. But I know you have other questions to get addressed, so thank you.
Yeah,
you can follow up.
Thank you, Representative Haley. And, you know, we appreciate when members are reading carefully and thinking about what's in these bills. And I would just encourage you to work with Representative Pinto offline about this because it does cross over. It has this weird jurisdictional thing. And it would probably be better to deal with that in the on the education side, but I don't want to lose the opportunity to have your concern dealt with. Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
I'll pass for now, Madam.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask Mary Solheim to come back to the testifying table. I have a question for Mary, if that's all right. I want to thank the authors for bringing this forward. I do know that we do have a real issue with this thing. And I think for me, it's totally a fiscal concern in that what will we do? And this is maybe for Mary. Thank you for coming back to the table. What will we do if we can do something major this year, but everything changes next year? So when you hear one-time money, and I work very closely with a lot of child care centers and things, and this reimbursement is a real issue, and there's some good components about this. But my concern is that when we look at our fully funding our system and our state every 2 years, not every year, that this really frightens me that we're making such a large down payment on this issue that would make a significant impact. But what if next year, when a lot of us members that are sitting here won't be here, the economy might be much different? It'll be after an election. We don't know what anything will look like in 2021. What will your center do if all of a sudden you have to get a rate cut? I want to just make sure we talk about this because it's very real.
Yep.
And I just want to ask that question because it's what I am having heartburn over is that we can't promise in future funding years right now with this. We don't have a fiscal. I know we're going to get it more later. But that is my biggest heartburn is, what will you do if you get a rate cut a year from now because we can't support this?
Ms. Solheim.
Wow. It's a good question. We're good budgeters. We're very, very, very good budgeters. And we have had to be for years and years. It doesn't frighten us as a 34-year-old veteran in the industry to move ahead with more money, because we are very used to operating at the very base. To give you an example, we have been doing one family of six kids for free for 3 years. We just received a payment from Hennepin County. We have been able to manage those situations as they happen by retaining good teachers. We did go through a time where we had to lay them off because of economic situations. That was 2009 maybe, but to begin to start making a difference and making a change is where we need to be. I know it would cause problems with, wow, we've solved the problem, so to speak, with all of this money. Now what? We are used to not having enough, but it would be sure nice for us to not have to worry so much, maybe just for that year. But
and
thank
Madam
you.
Chair, and I appreciate that
Baker.
Honest answer.
Yes.
Thank you. Because, again, I know for me, my only heartburn with the authors is that it's such a large down payment on this project and this issue that sometimes doing something a little bit more with moderation or with a little bit more of a smaller step might be more overall better for everyone, everything, that it has a much better chance of still being included in future funding years. And so we all see the need with our communities, and I caution us on this. I think it's a huge, huge number that I think will only multiply, obviously, many years down the road. And I assume the authors know what the tails might look like if it goes forward, and it's a massive number. To the authors, either one, do you know what some of the tails might roughly look like at this point?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker. The short answer is we do know that certainly they'll go up. I guess I'll point out, though, the real tails here are not making the investment, right? I mean, the real issue is when we don't provide this support, and, you know, Representative Baker, I work as a prosecutor, and I work outside the legislature. I'm seeing the impact of not having made investments 20 years ago. So those are the real tails that I guess that we really need to be concerned about. I mean, we have investments that we know will pay off. And so I think everybody in this room, from some different perspectives, can think about what the research shows. Why would we not do that? And even thinking about the amount that we could invest now, well, let's say we invest a smaller amount. What are we going to do with that money? There's no better investment than a young brain, right? That's the biggest payoff you can get. So that's our perspective, to say we can do this now. Why would we not do it now? And no matter what else happens, now we've just invested in this child and this family that will reap benefits for years to come.
So, Representative Pinto, just following up.
Representative Baker, please go through the chair.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. $1.5 billion, $2 billion. I get it. I'm not arguing your fact that we want to invest in our kids, but it's in the billions, I'm assuming, going forward with just this going forward.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Baker, I guess it depends somewhat on the time horizon, right? Eventually, presumably, it does get up to that level. It's just going to depend on sort of how long you're looking. I will say, as we looked at this, I mean, the $170 million on rates should be able, at 75th percentile, should be able to get us out probably beyond the first year and into several more. And, of course, we know that then, you know, it's kind of after 3 years we're in the past the horizon. So, but yeah, it does ratchet up.
Thank you. Question.
All right, thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick questions. I know there's other people want to talk also. You know, I represent a rural area, and it, you know, access to daycare is at a crisis there. I have a daycare client, and I also am acquainted with another daycare. These are smaller operators in my area, and I talked to both of them about Parent Aware. And their answer was they don't participate in it. They say it's convoluted and frustrating for a small provider to actually participate. So under your bill, if a daycare provider does not participate in the Parent Aware program, what's their reimbursement rate? Is that going to go up, or are they discriminated against as far as the bill is concerned?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Grunhagen, so participation in Parent Aware, I mean, even if a provider is not participating, they're still eligible to receive CCAP, and their rates certainly would go up, absolutely. And in fact, for your, if it's a family care provider in your community, their rate would increase to the 75th percentile. Right now it's set at the 25th percentile of a survey from 9 years ago. No wonder they're struggling. And then also it's set at a rate that would be based on a statewide rate, based on the highest cost. So yeah, though the provider would receive substantial support from this bill.
Madam Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that response. The, you know, the other thing is there anything in the bill, I was looking through it and I couldn't see that there is. You know, we've had, last session especially, we had a lot of evidence that we're really nitpicking the small provider. And in fact, I had a list, I don't have it with me now. You know, they could be fined for leaves in the entryway, a stick on the lawn, compared to the big providers who've had accusations of child abuse and yet nothing's done, okay? Now we could talk about political donations, but we won't talk about that here, okay? Is there anything in the bill to look at the amount of regulations that have been piled on, especially for small providers? Because we're social engineering a lot of them right out of business. And I hope that's not being done on purpose. I know none of you believe that, but it does seem like the agency is making it more and more difficult. I have a customer who's been a daycare provider for over 25 years. She's had it, okay? And she filled one little form out incorrectly, and rather than a email back to say, well, you need to correct this, they fined her immediately. It was the first time she made that mistake. She said that between the inspections that just stayed looking for something, they won't leave until they find something to find me about, and you know, this type of behavior, it does seem like we're discriminating against a small provider and trying to push all the children into large providers. So do you have anything in the bill that would address the some of the overregulation and frustration that small providers are seeing and actually leaving the daycare business? And again, this is creating a crisis of access in a rural area.
Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for that question. So I have two quick points. One, that the Child Care Task Force that is co-chaired by Representative Amy Wozlowick and, oh, is she? Perfect. And Representative Wozlowick, I was going to say, maybe joining us and be able to speak to a little bit more of what they discussed, but and co-chaired with Senator Kiffmeyer as well. So they have, you know, been working throughout the interim, and I may just let Amy speak to it since she's here. Some of the comments that you've received from directly from child care providers, family care, center care, et cetera.
Right. Representative Wozlowick, welcome to the committee. I don't know if you heard the question fully. Were you in the room when the question was asked?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Well, maybe Representative Grunhagen, can you really briefly restate the question?
I would love to.
Just briefly. It had to do with... Well, let me see if I can. Let me see if I can.
I'll give you a chance.
See if we all understood it. He's asking about the kind of picayune regulations that kind of tend to bedevil some of the small providers, and he's wondering if there's something in the bill. He views that perhaps as disadvantaging the smaller provider in favor of the larger one. Implication was in the question. And whether there's anything in the bill that helps that problem. And I know this is something that's been discussed a lot in this committee and others, so can you help us out with what the bill does with regard to that issue? Was that fair?
You're pretty good.
All right, good. I was listening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to provide some insight on that. So in Section 10, part of what we're doing here with regulation modernization is things that we heard directly from child care providers on the task force, as well as providers, representation from provider organizations. And they were actually most excited of all the work that we did in the task force thus far. They were most excited about the pieces we've included in the legislation here. And that is essentially, we're gonna be doing a couple of stakeholder processes around two larger ideas. One of them is a tiered violation system. So a tiered violation system is essentially, we're kind of moving in that direction, but it has different levels of sort of violations would have a different sort of follow-up. So, for example, if it's a minor violation, it might get a fix-it ticket. If it's something bigger, it might get a correction order. So trying to have a system based on the risk to the children in care and basing that sort of whatever the outcome is based on the risk. The higher risk ones would have a more severe action, and the lower risk ones would have not as severe of an action. So we're looking at having a consultant or an organization work on determining some of those risk factors and how that might look, and where the goal is to partner with organizations that have done this before in other states and work through this system to design the system and have the stakeholder input on that, and then as well with that system as well as abbreviated inspections. So for providers who have the full inspection and meet those guidelines, wanting to have something in place to say, we know that this provider meets these guidelines in terms of the predictability of them meeting all the rules, and so we want to have an abbreviated inspection. If any concerns come up, there would be a full inspection. So that's kind of a brief synopsis of what we're doing of the things we're doing in the legislation. There's also going to be, as part of this effort, there's also going to be some work done on actually updating the licensing standards. Because the tiered violation system would be based on standards, we want to make sure that we're also working to update the standards, and that process would be similar in terms of the amount of stakeholder engagement that would be happening.
Okay, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to make sure to highlight for members. So last session, in response to the kind of concerns Representative Grunhagen raised, we established a family child care task force. Just want to make sure we're totally clear on this, co-chaired by Representative Wozlawick and Senator Mary Kiffmeyer. And that task force worked on these issues, and this language, Section 10, referenced by Representative Wozlawick, is a product of that task force. So if you're concerned about the regulation of family child care, then you will be supportive of the bill, certainly Section 10 of the bill. This is directly responsive to that task force's work.
All right. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick follow-up. Just back to my other comment about reimbursement for daycare providers, small ones that don't participate in Parent Aware. You say that the reimbursement is not going to discriminate against those people. Is that actually listed in the bill where it says that?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen. There's no change to current law under that, Representative Grunhagen. So it's just it's the same as current law in terms of how that works. There's no greater enhancement here under CCAP relating to that. It's just the same as current law.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just Grunhagen. Comment is I'd sure like to see it in writing. If it's someplace else in statute, I'd like to see it, and otherwise reiterate it in this bill, because call me skeptical, but it seems like we're trying to social engineer into Parent Aware, and anybody who doesn't is getting penalized. Now, that's circumstantial evidence, but that's one of my concerns. Thank you, Madam.
All right, thank you. And Representative Wozlawick, I don't know if you have time to stay with us for a little bit in case there are other questions that will pertain to you, but I just wanted to say thank you for your work on that task force. I know that these task forces, we create lots of them in law, and we often ordain that legislators have to sit on them, and it just takes a ton of time, and you know, and it's extra time. So we appreciate that, your efforts and those of Senator Kiffmeyer on this work. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Kutiz Otun, and also Pinto and Wozlawick for joining you. We all know that child care, early childhood programs, assist the two generations, the parent and the child. And we're making the right investment in this program. So my question that I have is two questions. Number one is, do we have the number of families who are on the waiting list for the basic sliding fee? If you can quickly answer that question.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuer, I believe it's 1,200. I'm sort of looking to see if there's anybody who has a sense is able to be joining us.
Did you say 1,200?
Mr. Berg says it's 1,800.
1,800. Okay, 1,800, Madam Chair. So, Representative Neuer, I believe it's 1,800. I want to note that that number is a little bit, it's challenging, right, because a family may not bother getting on the waiting list because they know they can't get care. So it's presumably artificially low. And also it's a waiting list to then get these low subsidies, et cetera. So it's kind of, I don't know that it's a great measure of exactly how much need is not being met.
So, Madam Chair, the other question I have is, is the state going to be penalized if we don't change the rates based on the CCD funds discretion from the federal government.
Oh, thank you very much for asking that question, Representative Nora. That I wanted to ask that too, because, and so if you could, I don't know if you're the proper people to ask, or perhaps Ms. Mock could explain, but I did want to get into exactly that. What happens, you know, we are out of federal compliance. This was an issue last year. We wanted to raise the rate to get into federal compliance. The Senate basically did not want to do that. And so we are out of federal compliance. So I wanted to find out, what does that mean for the state? What are the possible ramifications going forward? So who can address that for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cattis-Watoon.
So what we have included in the bill will get us to minimum federal conformity. The rates are meant to be based on the 25th percentile of the most recent survey. And so as we've mentioned previously, currently our rates are based on the 2011 survey. And these surveys are done every 3 years. So the most recent one is 2018. There will be another one done next year in 2021. And so ongoing, it will be, as the bill is written, the most recent survey. But perhaps someone else can speak to exactly the amount of federal penalty that we will be subject to?
Yes, so we have someone from DHS to address that for us. Thank you. If you could
just... members of the committee, I'm Lori Posehn.
I'm sorry, say it again. If you could please move the mic. That mic is not well positioned. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lori Posehn, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm the manager for the Child Care Assistance Program at DHS.
Okay. Posehn?
Posehn, yes.
Posehn, okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming down.
Certainly. So as to penalties, yes, Minnesota is subject to penalties for two reasons. One, we had a corrective action plan that expired in October of this year, of 2019, and starting October 1 of next year, this year, 20, our next federal fiscal year, we are subject to a penalty of at least $2.75 million up to $5.5 million. The reason there are two amounts is we don't know if we'd be penalized for one or two reasons. One is rates, which we are clearly out of compliance with, and the other is a small item pertaining to family child care substitute caregivers needing to have some health and safety training in some language that didn't finish through the legislative process last year.
Okay, thank you for Madam Chair,
just
Representative Noor.
As a follow-up, the last question. Are there any other areas that the state is non-compliant with from the, you know, equal access provision and others?
Ms. Posehn.
Those are the two that we're clearly aware of. We also have to finish our background study process by getting providers through the background studies, the new type of background studies, and that's more of an implementation issue than a legislative issue. Excuse me. The studies are available. In fact, the department is funding studies right now. We're just doing a big push to get providers to take that enhanced background study. So that is a potential issue. We're less clear about the penalty portion of that, but that's a 5% penalty, whereas the other items that I named were 4% penalties of the total grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the home visiting Article 1 portion. I see that you've included visits to houses with others, pregnant women who are high risk or have high needs. And aside from the education gap that we have in our state, we also have a huge gap in maternal outcomes. So I'm very happy to see that incorporated in there. North Carolina did a very similar thing where they assigned healthcare workers to these families, and they almost eliminated their disparities. And so my question is there in the bill a portion that states how much of this grant goes to families that are just have young kids versus families that have pregnant women with high needs, or is that up to the county or the tribe to decide where that money goes? And then kind of along the same lines, how did the $30 million come to be?
Thank Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mann, thank you for the question. There is not, as far as I'm aware, a prioritization in terms of the grants. I'll note that there is a pre-existing grant fund within MDH, and I could be wrong, if somebody could please correct me if this is the case, but I believe that this is essentially how the program is set up right now in terms of that there are grants that come out from this MDH fund. This would be simply increasing money to that fund. And then there's a wide variety of home visiting programs that could be potentially funded through that fund. And as far as whether they would be more for pregnant women versus families with young kids, et cetera, there's not prioritization there. I will note that this is set up so that there's more evidence-informed funding, that right now it's required to be evidence-based. Regarding the $30 million, I think as with any piece of legislation, how does any particular set of numbers sound? Like basically, it seemed like that was a we know that home visiting has huge payoffs, it seemed like we know that that's another area where if you make a significant investment one time, it's really going to pay off. And so it seemed like looking at the different numbers available, that $30 million seemed like a good jump. I don't have the numbers in front of me exactly where we've been, but I think that'd be a significant increase, but not a 8,000% increase or whatever. So.
All right, thank you. Representative Hamilton, did you want to, you passed it before.
Madam Chair, I think it's relevant. On February 3rd, I met with city and county administrators, educators, a child care provider, business leaders, a banker, and then myself and my senator. That group had reached out with the YMCA, the church, the schools, and other business leaders. And addressing child care, they cannot come up with a business model that works. One that cash flows. And so to either the authors or the testifiers, can you share with me or us a business model that actually works, that cash flows?
Wow, great question. Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to emphasize, I think the challenge is like the business model does not work. So imagine that we had no public funding for education for older kids, and families just had to figure out whether on their entirely on their own how to do. Except imagine that the teacher the student ratio was for infants four children to one person. Like it just there is a need for the kind of support that we're talking about here, because the model just does not work. Parents could not possibly pay more than they do. They're already paying a huge percentage of their income. Providers could not possibly pay any less. There's certainly different angles that we can hit, and I know we've got a couple folks who have expertise in the room as well, but I guess I just want to make sure to get to the fundamental point that yes, this is, and it's not just being experienced in our state, it is the entire country. And what it is there's economic changes now that require both parents to be working. It used to be in decades past, you'd have a parent, maybe somebody's, you'd have grandma or an auntie who lives just down the street. Families are in different circumstances than they were, and the numbers just do not add up. I'm not sure if I had somebody else who was planning to come down for this, but that'd be my response.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Pinto. I mean, I guess, as I hear this, it seems like, there are needs that we have in society that, we have many needs that the market is great, and, we get innovation, and if we have competitive markets, functioning markets, we can push down prices and get all kinds of good stuff from that, but not everything fits that model. And that's what I hear you saying. This is definitely a public need, but not one that the market necessarily will accommodate without a significant amount of help.
Right.
Representative Katizawatun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have testifiers potentially from Women Venture and First Children's Finance. I don't know if either of you would care to speak to some of the success stories that you've seen.
We do have a few minutes, so we could certainly accommodate that. And I don't have anybody on the list at this moment, so okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to note too, I know that there's a parent who was planning to speak. We originally have a fourth testifier in any case, but there's a parent here who had wanted to be able to speak as well, if the time allows, who was planning to, but then had to leave, but then came back. So,
okay. And in the meantime, we have a question from Representative Bierman. So let's let him ask his question, and then we could have a testifier come down, and we'll hear from folks as long as we have the time. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you. The only question I had for the presenters was this model you talk about. That's not working here. I understand that in other places, other countries around the world, they do have models that work. And I know we are sometimes loath to accept models from around the world because they might be too different. But might you suggest any remarkable countries that we might want to emulate with results?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm actually glad you brought that up, Representative Bierman, because one thing I want to note, we often hear the point that the parent is the child's very best caregiver and teacher, of course. So I'll just put a plug in for paid family leave. And just note that what many countries do is they have the parent be with the child not for 1 week, as we perhaps do in our country, but for 6 months. For 12 weeks would be wonderful, we know that, and for even longer than that. But then, yes, beyond that, then is a recognition that, unlike many of the other needs that are not being met well by markets, this is one where it's not just care for the parent, but as Representative Noor said, it's two generations, it's actually having the child be benefited. So there are certainly countries, and actually there are models in America, the Defense Department. If you're in the military, you get phenomenal, high-quality, well-subsidized child care, and the results show. So there are models we can look to in all kinds of places.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bierman, follow-up? No. Okay. All right. We had a couple of testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please just give us your name and who you're representing, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Heidi Hagelgrade. I am the Chief Program Officer at First Children's Finance. Our organization works on the business side of childcare, so I can speak to your question about the business model. Parts of this bill actually start to address pieces that are really important to make sure that there is financial sustainability in childcare businesses, both for family childcare and childcare centers. Adequate rates that cover the cost of care are a step in the right direction. So I would encourage that you think about supporting the bill, because making sure that we have competitive reimbursement for serving low and moderate income kids is really important. And to your second question about, is there a model that works? There are many of them. I founded an effort inside of our organization in 2013 to work on rural child care. And I always start by saying anything is possible, but you've got to have a lot of people around the table to make it happen. And so making sure that there's access to low-cost capital, community facilities, adequate rates, and community support are all pieces of the puzzle that can make that business work. But given the current rates, that's a really difficult thing to make happen currently. So this bill does start to move us in the right direction. And if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. Representative Kunesh-Podein, I think, had a question. Or did you want to follow up, Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just having said that, and I'm unfamiliar whether there's ever been a study on what would it cost to go to a system that is 0 to 4 like we do for elementary school.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, actually, Representative Bierman, that is a very, very cutting-edge question. I know that there is a lot of looking at that around the country, and actually even here in Minnesota, a number of folks who were looking at that. I see Ms. Hagelbraid nodding as well. I'll say it's a substantial amount of money, but of course, as compared with the cost of not getting every child off to a great start, that's a much, much bigger cost. That's still being worked on, I believe.
All right. Thank you. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I was a family daycare provider for 5 years back in the day, and when I look at, well, there was really no regulation back there, very little, and I look at this and the kind of support that you have worked so hard to put towards this, I'm like just blown away, because this is nothing like I ever saw. I'm kind of curious about the grants, the Family, Friend, and Neighbor grant. Would you please explain that a little bit clearer and what that might entail?
So, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. So 40% of kids are cared for by family, friend, and neighbor caregivers, and so there's much less support. There actually was in the past a fair amount of support. This idea came from a group in Richfield, actually, and I should note Representative Mike Howard has really championed this, that is a consortium of family, friend, and neighbor providers who are working together to support one another, make sure they're providing quality care. So these would be grants available statewide to confirm that similar groups could apply to start in a given community, to say in our community, we're gonna work together to make sure that we're providing the very best care and the best support for one another that we can. It can be very isolating to be caring for a young child. Mm-hmm. And so we wanna make sure to provide that support.
Representative Kunesh-Pedin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And that is so important because you do feel isolated. You're at home, you're with kids all day long. One of the things that we did back in the day before we had any of this sort of support is we created activities. Like we had Music Marie that came around to our homes. She was on a rotation, daily rotation, and she brought musical instruments, and we sang and danced and played, and it really enriched our daycares. And then we were able to support each other in other ways when we heard of other, you know, really neat programs coming around. Would that be something that could be done under this grant, is to provide activities and resources from outside coming in and, you know, breaking up the day, giving people, you know, the kids something to look forward to, and also kind of giving the provider a little bit of a break and some fun on their own.
Representative Pinto.
And Madam Chair and Representative Kunesh-Pedin, yes, absolutely. I mean, in terms of supporting that kind of the networks that then are pulling them in, right? Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. All right. So, members, we could end a bit early, but before we do, I have to, I did not move the bill properly because it's a division report. So, Representative Pinto?
And Madam Chair, just a reminder, if you're willing, there is a parent who had wanted to testify.
Oh, yes. Okay, we certainly could do that. While I'm on this, let me just take care of this right now and make sure that we get this properly before the committee so that we can do the amendment, even though we're not going to vote on the bill right now. Okay, do I have to withdraw my previous amendment? Okay, so first of all, I have to withdraw my, we have to vote on that, right? I have to withdraw my previous motion. Okay, I don't have to vote on my withdrawal. So I'm gonna withdraw my previous motion, bringing the bill before the committee. And because this is a division report, so the motion, first of all, is to adopt the division report from the Early Childhood Division. So we need to vote, let's see. So first of all, we have to do that. We have to vote on that. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. So we have adopted the division report. Now I need to move the bill to get it before the committee, right? So now the motion is to move House File 1, right? Okay. So now the motion is to bring House File 1 before the committee. And actually the motion would be, just to bring it before the committee, because we're not going to vote the bill out today. Okay, so we're gonna lay it on the table after we get done with all this and get done with the hearing. So all those in favor of bringing House File 1 before the committee, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, that motion prevails. And now the main event, which is to remove the A6 amendment to have the bill in the order in which the author would like to have it considered. And so all those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, thank you for indulging me with that little bit of procedure. And then, so now we have another testifier. Welcome to the committee, and just please give us your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a quick clarification. My name is Noah Jacobs. I'm the director of a child care center in South Minneapolis, speaking on behalf of a parent who wasn't able to attend today. My center is 4-star parent aware rated and serves up to 168 children, mostly birth to age 5. Over 90% of the families I serve are low income and using child care assistance and or early learning scholarships to access our services. The parent who I'm here to speak on behalf of, Jesslyn, and her daughter Nayari, have been attending my center for 2.5 years since Nayari was a toddler. Child care assistance has given her the stability to continue in our program, where she is now in our pre-K classroom. Unfortunately, Nayari came down with some strep throat today and Jess was not able to make it, but I'd like you to read I'd like to read to you something that Jesslyn wrote. Quote, having child care assistance helps me tremendously. I am extremely grateful that my child is afforded this opportunity. It makes it so I am able to provide better at home, things like extra groceries from all food groups, or maybe having a mommy-daughter outing, or getting my daughter geared up for our cold Minnesota winter. I am beyond grateful, and I hope more parents are able to receive this assistance. It definitely lifts a weight off your shoulders. Thank you for helping me not only to provide for my daughter, but for giving her access to this wonderful education opportunity. Speaking as myself again, I'm excited about House File 1, because it would allow more families like Jesslyn's the opportunity to benefit from child care assistance. Thank you so much for having me today.
All right, well, thank you very much for your testimony. So that is a lovely note to end this hearing. Yeah. So with that, I'm gonna lay the bill on the table. We will let members know when we have the fiscal note. We will notice the bill again, bring it up, give members plenty of time to review the fiscal note, because this is a large expenditure, and it has a lot of pieces to it. So with that, members, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.